Good morning, and thank you for being here. For those of you that don't know me, I am a registered psychotherapist, so that may help set the tone for some of the questions you'll hear in what I'm talking about this morning. My comments today will focus on a statement I hear quite often in my counseling office. I read it in the newspapers and I hear it on the news. I think it's a fascinating statement, at least for me, because it contains so much food for thought. And the statement is, I don't feel safe anymore. I don't feel safe anymore. Now, as I ponder this statement, I have many questions, as therapists do, for the person who shared it. Now, I'm not going to ask you to answer out loud to any of these questions, because it could turn into a therapy session, and I'd love that. But it's kind of big. Most of those are like 12 to 15 people. And so as I throw these questions out, I just ask that you ponder them in your mind and explore them. Some of these questions are, if you don't feel safe now, did you feel safe at some earlier time? When? How was that different than right now? What's changed for you since that safer time? What does it mean to feel safe? Here comes the therapist part. Is safe even a feeling? And what does it feel like when you say you don't feel safe anymore? Now to get a bit existential, is it even safe to feel safe? If we really feel safe, are we ignoring the facts and possibly making ourselves more vulnerable? Is it even possible to feel safe these days? Is desiring to feel safe a worthwhile, achievable goal? Maybe. Maybe the writers of the scriptures we read today were just dreaming. So let's look at this idea of feeling safe. Some people suggest that having laws and rules will make us feel safe. I recall my mother saying, there ought to be a law. Anytime she was frustrated by something she saw and disapproved of. There ought to be a law against whatever it was that she was observing at the time. Now, maybe it's genetic, because I've used the expression myself a few times. Well, do laws and rules make us, or help us make us feel safe? I think so, in some instances. Think about, buckle up before you drive. Obey the speed limits. Have working smoke and CO2 detectors in your residence. Keep required insurance policies paid up. Yet, other laws make us wonder what folks were thinking when they drafted them. Did you know, in Sudbury, it is a criminal offense, punishable by a fine of up to $5,000, to attach a siren to a bicycle. I don't know, bells and horns maybe, but not sirens. In Fort Capel, Saskatchewan, teens wearing shoes with laces untied may be fined for violating a local bylaw prohibiting untied shoes for teens. Now, as an aside, and I know there's people in here that might be thinking, oh, geez, he's kind of slipping off topic here. As an aside, our National Conservative Party leader started his career in politics in Fort Capel. Don't know about the shoelaces, but you know. Velcro came along, yeah. In Petrolia, Ontario, it's illegal to whistle between 11 p.m. and 7 a.m. In Alberta, their health and safety code states it's against the law to paint a wooden ladder. If it's old and rickety, it must stay that way. I don't know about you, but I've never found a paint that hid a broken rung. Now, Vancouver enacted legislation in 1947 that made it illegal to sell a stove within city limits except on Wednesdays. That law was repealed 40 years later, and you got to wonder why. And here's a couple more. In Alberta, I have friends out there, I'd say it to them, it's against the law to set fire to someone's wooden leg. I'm sure there's a story behind that one. I just don't know what it is. Now, in Montreal, it's against the law to place a for sale sign in the window of a moving car. Putting it on when it's moving, or... Here's another one that I'm sure you'll like, especially for our friends south of the border. In the state of Georgia, it's illegal to carry an ice cream cone in your back pocket on Sunday. In Maryland, persons may not swear while on the highway. I know, you're all taking that personally. None of you swear while you're on the highway. No. Now, and one more, so you will hopefully feel very safe while visiting Toronto. There is a still existing bylaw that prohibits dragging a dead horse down Yonge Street on Sundays. It didn't say in the book Monday through Saturday where it may be okay. I don't know. Okay, so maybe we won't feel completely safe just because we have laws. What about more detailed labels on products? In a sports store, there was a label on a fishing lure, one of those with those three big ugly steel hooks on it, and the label said, harmful if swallowed. Do fish read? On a snow sled, beware, sled may develop high speed under certain snow conditions. I hope so. That's why I want to buy it. Or this one. I love this one. It's old. You may have heard it, but I really love this one. You remember the day when they had those little tiny, lightweight, fold-up infant strollers? The label said, remove infant before folding stroller. My apologies to all the lawyers in the audience. So maybe warning labels can help us a little, but most people still don't feel safe anymore. So now what? Maybe if we double our efforts to follow the path Jesus invites us to follow, we will feel safe. Maybe our efforts will earn us a pass through all of the chaos that we see in the world today. Maybe if we live good lives, bad stuff will never happen to us. I have met people who firmly believed in that last statement. Live a good life, and bad things won't happen to them. Now, I usually meet them after a tragedy has struck, either them or somebody close. These folks are shattered. Like their treasured belief system, as they have firsthand experience, that bad stuff does happen to good people. Maybe some of you have seen Rabbi Harold Kushner's book on this very topic. If you haven't, have a look. So let's go back to I don't feel safe anymore. Externals can help us feel somewhat safe. But I think to get to the core of the issue, we need to move inward. Spoiler alert. Safe isn't a feeling. It's more like a state of mind. Safe is not an emotion. Now, emotions are happy, sad, glad. And now for another important insight. Emotions follow or are created by our thoughts, in most cases. Emotions follow our thoughts when created by our thoughts. For example, let's say we have an opportunity to explore a large garden where there are many flowers, bushes, well-maintained walking trails in the wooded areas. Maybe it'll be our first time to visit the Royal Botanical Gardens, the RBG, which is not far from right here. What might we think about the possibility of visiting the RBG? Well, example one, thought. Wow, I have heard great things about the RBG. I hear it's a gorgeous place. Going to get my camera, my water bottle, dress appropriately, and go explore. I can't wait. What emotions might follow those thoughts? Excitement? Joy? Happiness? What about thought option number two? Whoa, that place is big. I've never been there before. I could get lost. I hate being lost. And I'm sure there's bugs in there. I hate bugs. What about snakes? Geez, maybe spiders. I'd just die if I met a spider or a snake. Now, what feelings might typically follow those thoughts? Fear? Panic? Disgust? Snakes? Ugh. And we're only thinking about the opportunity to go to the RBG. Even thinking, we can have different emotional experiences, all depending on our thoughts. And we haven't even left home yet. We're just thinking about going to the RBG. Now, this simple exercise is not designed to point out good or bad feelings, as all feelings are legitimate. The exercise is designed to help us increase our awareness of the impact our thoughts have on the creation of our emotions, our feelings. If we say, "I don't feel safe anymore," we are likely feeling some level of fear. Fear is one of many legitimate emotions we can experience. Fear, well managed, can motivate us to act in many different positive ways, maybe even save our lives. Fear, however, poorly managed, can lead to more fear and sometimes illness. Have a look at Gavin De Becker's book, The Gift of Fear. And yes, fear can be a gift. So the scriptures chosen for today challenge us. Don't be anxious. Don't worry. But is that possible? Isn't it insulting to tell someone not to be anxious or don't be afraid, especially when their life is falling apart? Well, maybe. Maybe if our timing is off. What if we personalize the verses? Let the verses speak to us. So, for example, when I read those passages, I might read, "Ron, don't be anxious. Ron, don't worry." When the dentist tells me to relax, and I've already got both arms off the chair about torn off, the words are a waste of time. It's too late. But if, before the dentist shows up in the room, I talk myself into a relaxed state, maybe I'll calm down at least a couple of notches. But really, how do we create an inner sense of calm even in the midst of all of the situations we hear about or we find ourselves in almost every day? And my continuing question to ponder, is this even possible? And here's my answer. You know, contrary to all the psychiatrist jokes who just throw questions back when you ask questions, I'll answer that one. I believe it is possible to create inner calm even in the midst of chaos. Right. How? Well, a few ideas. For goals to be achieved, we need to set them in positive language. It may be okay to tell ourselves, don't worry, but that, at least I find, usually doesn't work so well. We need to shift our focus to what we want instead. Don't be afraid, for example, needs to be restated. I want to have a sense of security even in dark times. Now, here's a simple demonstration of why I think it's important to focus efforts on what we want instead of what we don't want. Okay? You ready? For the next 10 seconds, and I will clock you, do not think of hot fudge sundaes. Do not. Do not think of all that hot fudge. Do not think of all those peanuts and all of those calories. Don't think of any of these, and I'm starting now. Probably not a scientific study, but my hunch is every one of you had an image or two of a hot fudge sundae that you've had in your lifetime. You maybe even started to salivate a little bit, excepting for those of you that are lactose intolerant and you have bad experiences with ice cream. But when we focus on what we don't want, it's the very thing we focus on which is counterproductive. If we are concerned about what we eat and we want to make some changes, rather than beating up on ourselves every time we think of food we don't want to eat, try this approach instead. When an image of the food you don't want to eat pops into your conscious, just notice it. No judging, just notice. Then thank that image for reminding you it's time to go for a walk, get a glass of water, do something you want to do. You know, it's really easy to be hard on ourselves. I shouldn't be thinking about hot fudge sundaes. He told me not to think about hot fudge sundaes. I am thinking about hot fudge sundaes. I am so weak. What is wrong with me? I have no willpower, and I can't even follow simple directions. I guess I'm a failure. Really? We do that. Telling ourselves not to think a thought when it's already there is at best too late, and maybe just plain silly. Just notice, name it, move on. You can do this. Okay. The ideas sound pretty good in theory, but how do you apply them to the day-to-day life that we live? If we happen to watch the news and hear about the latest horror wherever, and there's a lot of them, or we read the paper and we realize about all of the tension and the fusses, for example, over in Hamilton, just around the bay. So how do we find this sense of calm in the midst of all of this? Well, given that we may not feel safe for a variety of reasons, I'm going to pick a couple of possibilities and work through them. Example one, and I'm being general so that you and your thinking about this can identify your own particular items. So we own some stuff we have collected over the years, stuff that has value to us. I got lots of stuff. I'm sure you do. Think about what your stuff is and think of its importance to you. Then think of what it'd be like to have all that stuff vanish. Perhaps by some natural disaster, or having to move from your home country, or so many other ways that stuff can be gone. Some of us might not know what to do without our stuff. Now, if we are that tied to our stuff, I believe we're setting ourselves up for disappointment or worse. If we include our jobs, our careers, even our volunteer positions, in what we consider our stuff, Dr. Wayne Dyer has a little poem for us. I'm going to modify it just a touch. If you are what you do, or if you are what you have or own, and you don't, then you aren't. If we are what we do or have, and we don't, it disappears, then who are we? If we define ourselves by our stuff, whatever that stuff is, I think we're feeding right into, I don't feel safe anymore. Matthew 6, 19 to 21 speaks directly to this very situation. Do not store up riches for yourselves on earth, where moths and rust destroy and robbers break in and steal. Instead, store up riches for yourselves in heaven, where moths and rust cannot destroy and where robbers cannot break in and steal. For your heart will always be where your riches are. Example 2. Now we can get that there are challenges with focusing on our stuff. Recall the stories about people who lost everything, all their stuff. Think of the Fort McMurray fires. Think about the floods in Ontario, Quebec, and the Maritimes this spring. Stuff, all gone. But what about the intangible stuff we all have? And we believe to be very important, like our health, our sense of purpose, or our reason to live. We have this well-thought-out plan for life. It's what they taught us in college. Have one. We have it all laid out. We have a vision. We have a map of the journey we want to take. We know where we want to go, what we want to do, what we want to become. And it all falls apart. With a surprise, serious medical diagnosis. A divorce. All the investments that you have for your retirement shrinks. I won't speak for you, but the bumper sticker that states, don't worry, be happy, doesn't help me much in times like that. So I'm going back to the passage from Matthew. The writer questions in verse 27, why we worry about food and clothing? And asks, and I love this one, can any of you live a bit longer by worrying about it? If you're online banking, you know how much is in your bank right now. Now, don't go for your cell phones right now and check. Just hold off on that. So imagine you looked at the numbers and you don't like them, so you worry. Come on, Royal Bank, more cash. It doesn't work. So we think about the impact of worrying and how unproductive or non-productive it is. People often ask me if I worry, and most days I will say I don't worry. I'm concerned about things, but I don't worry. Because for me, worrying reminds me of times that I've stuck in a maritime snowstorm in a humongous snowbank. We had real storms down there, by the way. And not like this heavy frost you have around here. Stuck in a snowbank, engine racing, tire spinning, tire smoking, and I'm going nowhere. All that energy spent, no payback. I'm still stuck in a snowbank, and the snowbank doesn't care. Now, for all of you, those of you who aren't great readers, I haven't forgotten you. I have a simple exercise we all can do anytime we feel fear, anxiety, or worry. It's so easy you might think I'm being disrespectful of how you're thinking and feeling in difficult times. Not true. This very exercise is being taught, has been, and continues to be taught to the men and women of the Canadian military, fire departments, police, and paramedic personnel right across Canada. By the way, you'd have to pay serious money to take the course, so I'm giving you the big chunk of it for free this morning because I sat in one of the training sessions. I thought, really, you're doing this with all these brilliant people? This? Yeah. What I'm about to present sounds like the story we heard last Sunday from 2 Kings 5. Naaman, as you recall, was a very important man, and he had a serious skin condition that caused him some grief. So he heard about Elisha, and he was referred to that prophet because he heard that prophet would cure his illness, his condition. So the prophet, being a busy guy, sent his servant. He said, yeah, Naaman's coming down that old dusty road there. Just go on out and give him the message. What do you got to do? So you recall, the message was incredibly simple. So simple, Naaman was insulted. And he says, you got to be kidding me. But if you remember that story, Naaman had said, this simple task, once completed, that his skin would be healed. And I think that's a great story about how we tend to dismiss simple solutions. So here's my simple description for calming your mind when challenges arise. This is not to make your challenges go away, because it doesn't work that way, but it will help calm our mind so we can deal with whatever it is. You ready? One word. Breathe. That's it. I know, sounds pretty silly, doesn't it? Because all of you are breathing, I think, from what I can... It would appear that way anyway. But the type of breathing that I'm suggesting now, and I will explain it, is not the way we usually breathe. I'm talking about something called diaphragmatic, or what some call belly breathing. If you do various exercises, you know what I'm talking about. Most of the time, we breathe incredibly shallow. And that's not a negative put down, it's a statement of fact. We breathe about to here. And especially when we panic. And then we stop. Here are the instructions. Follow along if you want to experience a different way to breathe. And notice any sensations you experience as you do this exercise. Seriously, if you feel a little dizzy, just stop. Now, some of you may have never heard of this silly exercise, and you say, where's my diaphragm? Okay, it's about where your belly button is, or about where your belt is, all right? The exercise is very simple. We breathe in through our nose, counting quietly inside to the count of three. Hold it to the count of three. And to the count of three, blow out quietly through your mouth. Hold the emptiness to the count of three. Repeat. In. Hold. Out. Hold. In. Hold. Out. Hold. You can do that number of reps as you get used to it. Slowly in through your nose and out through your mouth. Build up that count as you get used to it. Many folks find this exercise incredibly calming, especially if they've done it regularly. Like any exercise, as you do it regularly, it becomes second nature. And once you get the hang of it, you can deep breathe anywhere at any time. No one's going to know what you're up to. But they will be curious how you can be so calm in whatever chaos you find yourself. Spoiler alert, I use this all the time when I get called in for trauma intervention. And I hear the story of the people I'm going to meet and what they've been through, and I'm thinking, how do I do this? And I, because the last thing you want is your trauma counselor coming in and going, you know, you don't want that. Maybe I'll do a comedic skit sometime and do that, but you know, but this is something that we can do anywhere. Now, how does this work? This sounds really goofy. How does it work? Well, when we're counting, that's why it's important to internally be counting. One, two, three. At least for those seconds when we're counting, we are not focusing on whatever it is that we were upset about. Okay, that's step one. And then that extra oxygen we draw in flushes out the carbon dioxide from our brain, which causes our brain to slow down. When we are fearful, anxious, or worried, we tend to breathe quite shallow. Shallow breathing brings in only minimal oxygen and expels only minimal carbon dioxide. Our brains in this situation are not functioning at peak capacity. We are not using all of our smarts. Deep breathing turns a counterproductive behavior into a positive behavior that allows us to relax and be able to look for possible solutions to whatever has caused the stress reaction in the first place. Now, I recently met a woman who had been assaulted at her place of work, and as she talked, I noticed an inner strength, something I could sense, even through her tears. When it was appropriate, I asked her where her strength was coming from. She smiled and quoted verse 4 from the 23rd Psalm. Even though, and her translation was NIV or KJV, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you're with me. She'd been terrified at the time and very upset by the assault, but she was able to find comfort and support from one of the best-known psalms, Psalm 23. I was truly impressed with her resilience. So the next time you notice yourself saying, I don't feel safe anymore, I hope you will recall the Bible text read today and the ideas that I've shared. I hope when you next experience troubled times, you will remember to breathe, then as calmly as possible, explore your thoughts about what is troubling you, knowing that thoughts create emotions. Perhaps during your troubled times, you'll reread the passages presented today. And as you reread the 23rd Psalm, see if you can get into the mindset of that writer. Sense the power of his belief that God is always with him, guiding and comforting him, even through difficult times. Then claim all of that for yourself. So let's listen again to the first few verses of that very special psalm. The Lord is, not maybe, the Lord is my shepherd. I have everything I need. He lets me rest in fields of green grass and leads me to quiet pools of fresh water. He gives me new strength. He guides me in the right paths, as he promised. Even if I go through the deepest darkness, I will not be afraid, Lord, for you are with me. Amen. Thank you.